You're with Jeremy Beck on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
That's right, and I'm filling in for Mike Ryan on The Mike Ryan Show. Just have a look at some news headlines. US must end blind engagement with China, says Pompeo. The former Secretary of State says Washington must work to prevent a Chinese century. The US must abandon the old paradigm of blind engagement in its relations with Beijing if it wants to prevent Xi Jinping's dream of a Chinese century. Wow. That's a language of conflict, I would say, from Mike Pompeo. And he said this in a four-day visit to Taiwan. Now, I suggest he listened to Matthew Errett, who's a regular guest on TNT Radio, and also he's the co-founder and vice president of the Rising Tide Foundation. The Rising Tide Foundation looks to raising everyone at once in win-win relationships. And I think that is the pathway for the future if the world is going to have peace, because this kind of conflict of a unipolar world is very, very dangerous when we have leading powers with nuclear weapons, and it can't end very well if the United States intends to stamp out China. I think they both can work together, and it would be a much better world if they did, because right now it's looking very, very volatile and very, very uncertain. In other headlines, headless body found 42 years ago in Hudson Valley, ID'd through DNA. A headless, handless body stuffed inside a travel trunk near a dumpster in Hudson Valley in New York State nearly four decades ago has been identified as a missing hair salon worker thanks to DNA testing and genealogical research. New York State Police announced Friday that the mangled corpse recovered on the 20th of March 1980 at the Hudson View apartment complex in Fishkill was that of Anna Papalardo Blake. So DNA can be used for useful crime solving, and I think that's a good thing. At the same time, you've got to wonder what else it could be used for. I think the technology can be very useful, but also particularly or potentially dangerous if it got in the wrong hands. What if that was used by deep state operatives to frame people up? Who knows what's possible? But interesting that those sorts of crime cases can be solved through DNA. Wonders technology and technology can be used for good or used for evil. And that's the challenge that we're facing more and more in the world today. Why not give TNT Radio a follow? We are on all the major social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Stream us wherever you are.
I listen on Alexa.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
The funeral of Queen Elizabeth II has grabbed the attention of many millions of people in Commonwealth nations and many others too. Now we have King Charles III taking over as head of state in all realms of the Commonwealth. Where does that leave the debate of a republic? I'll ask my next guest. Professor Andrew McLeod has a deep understanding of today's changing geopolitical landscape. His diverse portfolio career covers for-profit, not-for-profit, military, and academia. He currently is CEO and chair of Griffin School, Griffin Law, is a non-executive director on multiple companies in the United Kingdom, Middle East, and Australia, is a visiting professor at King's College London, a council member at Keele University and Vice Chancellor's Distinguished Fellow at Deakin University, and is co-founder of anti-child abuse charity Hear Their Cries. Welcome to TNT Radio, Andrew.
Thank you, Jeremy. I hope all's well. And we can talk some more about that DNA issue, because I've got another use for that that you might be interested in. We can also talk about Taiwan, if you like, too, as well as hopefully the soon-to-become Australian Republic.
Absolutely. All those subjects are very important, and I'd love to hear what you have to say about DNA. And I was going to ask you about Taiwan and China and Ukraine and other issues, because they're all very, very important at this moment. But let's start out on the Republic issue. You, I believe, were at the funeral or attended the big crowds in London. Is that correct?
I was in London. I wasn't in the funeral, but I was certainly wandering the streets in London and watching the procession go by, and the British were doing pageantry at the best, which the British are very good at.
Right. And I understand you are a Republican that you've mentioned, and many people have differing views. And my position is I'm a Republican too, but I don't think it's appropriate to be bagging someone who's just died. I don't think it's going to win the hearts and minds of the monarchists. But I do passionately believe we do need a head of state, an elected head of state that is not from some hereditary line. And I do have big problems with King Charles III in his political advocacy, his close connections to Klaus Schwab, and I'm certainly opposed to the World Economic Forum's agenda and how Prince Charles is very aligned with those. What are your concerns along this subject?
Well, I largely agree with you. I think Australia is capable of having its own head of state. I don't see why we need a born-to-rule elitist foreign family being our head of state. Well, let me say that again, because this is not having a go at Queen Elizabeth, because I agree with you, you don't speak ill of the dead, but they are born to rule, literally. They're a monarchy. They are elitist. They sit on top of the class system, and they are a foreign family. So currently Australia's head of state is a born to rule, elitist foreign family. What is wrong with Australia that we require an elitist, born-to-rule foreign family to be our head of state? Why can't we have our own? It's as simple as that.
Mm, I agree, 100%. Monarchy.
I do have to say Elizabeth did a great job within a rotten institution. You know, here's another thing that someone might think is a contradiction. I have no issue with the monarchy being head of state in the United Kingdom. I just have an issue with the monarchy being a head of state in Australia, because the United Kingdom is an elitist society. It is a class-based society. It is a Protestant society, and the crown is born in the United Kingdom. So my main objections to the monarchy in Australia are, A, the head of state is not Australian, B, the symbolism of an elitist head of state doesn't match well with the egalitarian society of Australia. C, the fact that the head of state has to be a Protestant runs as anathema to Australia's multi-religious society, and also the favouritism over males over females that is reflected in the monarchy doesn't represent equality that we want in Australia. Now, some people will say, well, they've changed the male dominance in the monarchy, and I, to which my response is they have, but only if Prince George's first child is female. So it won't kick in unless Prince George's first child is female. And if Prince George's first child is male, then the male dominance still stays until Prince George's child's child is female. Mm. I just want Australians to say, is it right for Australia's head of state to be a born-to-rule, elitist foreign family? And none of that is meant to be derogatory. Each of those three statements is accurate. They are elitist, they are the epitome of born-to-rule, and they are foreign.
Oh, that's correct. We did have an opportunity in Australia to vote for a so-called republic in 1999. Mm. I actually, at the time, voted no, not because I was a monarchist, I wasn't, but I didn't like the model. Do you see many Australians felt the same way back in 1999?
I think so. Now, I was the deputy convener for Victoria for the Australian Republican Movement, so I was very, very active in the 1999 referendum. And people said in part, you know, that if it ain't broke, don't fix it, to which my response was, well, the system of government in Australia is not broken. but the symbol of government is the symbolism of the head of state. So how do you change the symbol of government without changing the system of government? And what we proposed in 1999 is that we would change the symbol of government without changing the system of government. So what we had then is a difficult decision to make, because the symbol of government is based on a ceremonial head of state with no political power or political base. That's what the current system is, where the governmental power base sits within the parliament and the prime minister. If you had a directly elected president, and I understand why some people would like a directly elected president, that would fundamentally change the system of government, because you would then have two centres of political power, the prime minister and the president. So the proposal that was put in 1999 that was rejected was trying to replicate the power of government sitting with parliament and the prime minister, and the symbol of government sitting with the governor general effectively. So what they proposed in 1999 was a appointment of the president, which is considerably more democratic than the appointment of the crown, and far more democratic than the appointment of the governor general. But it didn't fly with the population, partly because the population didn't understand the system that we currently have now. Because how does the Governor General get appointed? The Governor General is appointed by Her Majesty, or His Majesty, on the advice of the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister doesn't have to consult with Cabinet, doesn't have to consult with Parliament. You don't even need a vote through Parliament. The Governor General is at the whim of the Prime Minister. And what was being proposed was a president elected by a joint sitting, two-thirds majority of a joint sitting of the Houses of Parliament. Now, by having a two-third majority joint sitting of Parliament, what you guarantee through that process is that the politician, the president would not be a politician, because both sides of politics would have to agree to the person, so you're not going to get a political hack in there. The irony is, when John Howard came out and said, you don't want a politician's president, let's have a directly elected one instead, a directly elected president has to be, by definition, a politician, because one, they've got to be elected. Two, the only organisations that have the ability to put up a person to be elected in a national vote are the political parties. And this was the great irony. The one way to guarantee that the president is not a politician is to have a two-thirds majority vote of the Houses of Parliament, because both sides of politics have to agree. If you have a generally elected president, then he has to be a politician, because only politics can actually run a national political campaign. That was the irony of 1999. A lot of people who objected to the model didn't want a politician as president, but the model that was being proposed is the only model that would guarantee you didn't have a politician. But I understand people want to have a say in the process. And the issue that we now have is it's not been a question of we don't want a monarchy. It's we can't decide on what type of republic we want to have. Do we want to have a republic like Ireland, where you have a ceremonial president? Do we want to have a republic like France, where the president has international affairs powers but no domestic affairs powers? Or do you want to have a republic like the United States, where the president is everything? You know, I favour the Irish model, which is essentially the same as we have now, except it's an elected president rather than an appointed governor general.
I think one of the important issues is in the world that we're in right now, it's a globalist takeover of many nations. So many nations don't truly have sovereignty, because they're so controlled by big banks, big multinationals, and they can't make their own decisions for their sovereign nation anymore. So regardless of what model, that any nation doesn't have the same powers that they once had. They've lost a lot of sovereignty. Do you see that as a big issue?
Well, I don't necessarily see it as a big issue, but it's true that as the world is more globalized and more interconnected, we have, and all countries have, less autonomy to make decisions over its own borders. You actually do have the option of closing your borders and having 100% autonomy over your own people and your own economy. You do have that option. North Korea does it, but it doesn't work out so well. And the problem is that sovereignty is ceded to an extent when you agree to collaborate with other people, be it in politics, military, or economics. But you choose how much you're going to cede. Like, take the United Kingdom. They had one of the world's best trading arrangements with the European Union, but they lost some of their sovereignty as a result. By having Brexit, they regain some of their sovereignty, but they lose this great favoured trading status they had with the EU, which is 51% of their trade. And most economists are now agreeing in the United Kingdom that the removal of the United Kingdom from Europe is costing up to 3% of GDP over the medium and long term. Now, some people will say it's worth it for the sovereignty, and some people will say it's not worth it. And certainly when you're in Britain at the moment, you see the falling of the pound, the shrinking of the economy, you see the cost of a series of decisions that are being made. The problem, though, now is Brexit is compounded with COVID, is compounded with the war in Ukraine, which is compounded with the energy crisis. So we're not really sure how you allocate which negative to which event.
Yes, understand. Now, we do need to take a break now. This is TNT Radio.
You should hear what Jeremy Nell is talking about.
How significant is this COVID era in the big picture? Is it merely just yet another event, or is it significantly more important?
More than just another stage, it was a massive stage, because it pushed forward the agenda very, very quickly in many different areas. And if I pick one up and go with the economy, which is of course very topical and relevant now, lockdown was not to do with protecting the public from a virus. A virus, by the way, that is still yet, after all this time, to be shown to exist. And so you had the lockdown with the motivation of throwing a massive spanner in the works of the global economy. Amazon did great. Facebook did great. All these major corporations did great because they weren't, quote, locked down. But all these smaller businesses, medium businesses, and even bigger businesses that are not connected to this cult were locked down and, of course, suffered enormous economic and financial damage as a result.
Jeremy Nell on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
The mission of Paralyzed Veterans of America is clear. Accessibility. Veterans who have served and sacrificed the best of themselves deserve access to the best our country has to offer. Access to meaningful employment. Access to the veterans' benefits they've earned, accessible homes and vehicles, and access to every part of their communities. With PVA staff working inside VA hospitals, no other veterans organization has provided more real-time, ongoing support for paralyzed veterans and their families. PVA is proud to serve veterans across all branches, all generations, and all conflicts. Our nation's heroes fought for your independence. Join PVA in fighting for theirs at pva.org.
The electric vehicle, saving the planet, killing children. We mandate that the truth be told. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
This is Jeremy Beck, and my guest is Professor Andrew McLeod. And we've been talking about the monarchy and a republic, or potential republic. Now, Andrew, do you see that many Republicans have just gone really quiet right now, such as Jacinda Ardern, who said just the other day, and she's been a Republican for a long time, but the other day, oh, it might happen sometime, but sometime in my lifetime. That's a long time. She's not an old lady. What do you think, Andrew?
I think it was appropriate to be quiet for the week of the Queen's mourning period. But now let's ramp it up. And look, I'll make a bold prediction for you. Out of the current Commonwealth countries that are still monarchies, about 14 of them, the last three to change will be Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. Somehow the smaller countries have got their self-confidence and the courage to move towards being republics, but Canada, New Zealand, and Australia all seem to have a little bit of a confidence problem and aren't prepared to stand on their own two feet. It's a great irony, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I think Australia should look at its history. We did have a big Republican movement back in the 1840s and 1850s, anyone who's looked at the Australian history, and it got squashed, and then we had the Federation in 1901. And it's popped up all the way along throughout history, but it's always got squashed out. So when will it happen?
Can I make a link that you may agree or may not agree?
Yeah.
Let's talk about the Uluru Statement from the Heart for a moment. Now, a lot of Indigenous activists talk about the provision of the Uluru Statement of the Heart that says sovereignty was never ceded. And they're right, but they misunderstand what they're saying. Sovereignty never ceded doesn't necessarily mean it wasn't lost. It just means it wasn't freely given. And I think everyone agrees that Indigenous people didn't freely give sovereignty across. But the second part of that phrase in the Uluru Statement from the Heart is sovereignty was never ceded and is now shared between the Indigenous population and the Crown. So now, according to the Uluru Statement of the Heart, there's one group of people that is not included, and that is the non-Indigenous Australian people. And I would love to see the Uluru Statement of the Heart change to say sovereignty was never ceded and is now shared by all Australians, because we need to get rid of the Crown. And actually, the Uluru Statement from the Heart, issues around the voice to Parliament and the Republic are all linked, because it comes back to a question for Australians about us answering the question, what is our identity and what do we wish our identity to be? And I would love us to get to the point where we're all confident enough to say Australian sovereignty is shared by all Australian people.
I think all Australian people should share that sovereignty too. I don't like to see the division of black versus white or any group versus any group. I think it's very dangerous. But
I agree with that.
Certain political agendas are afoot, and I know how it works, such as Black Lives Matter. I don't see that as a movement at all, that which is uniting people. It seems to me to be dividing people. The Indigenous Statement of the Heart, I know a regular guest on TNT Radio, Josephine Cashman, has a lot to say about that issue, and we perhaps could talk about that another day. But I do want to move on to some other issues. DNA that you wanted to comment on. I'd love to hear what you have to say there.
So the DNA story you talked about at the top of the hour is using a thing called genetic genealogy. Now, if you commit a crime, you, Jeremy, commit a crime, and you leave DNA on the crime scene, we can take that DNA and if we find an extended relative on your mother's side on 23andMe and an extended relative on your father's side on 23andMe or Ancestry.com, and we follow the paperwork between those extended relatives, the only human beings in the world that share the DNA with someone on your mother's side and someone on your father's side are you, your siblings, and your children. That's it. Mm-hmm. So you actually don't need someone's DNA to triangulate who they are. And that's how this genetic genealogy works. So they find a body, they find an extended relative on the mother's side, extended relative on the father's side, triangulate back, and therefore they identify who it is. Now, I'm using that exact same technology to find and hold to account sex abusing men. So for men who go overseas, either as aid workers or as sex tourists, and rape and abuse women and children overseas, if that woman or child gets pregnant and has a child as a result, I take DNA for resulting child, isolate the paternal side of the DNA, compare it to the 23andMe databases and find the fathers. Now, we did an experiment in the sex slums north of Manila, and we took DNA from six mother children pairs. And of those six mother children pairs, we found five fathers, two Australian, one Canadian, one Californian, and one British. And we are now getting justice for the children by taking their fathers to court and making them pay a child support order and getting children the nationalities that they're entitled to by rights of their birth. And where the mother was under 16, we can get a prosecution of the father for child rape.
Fascinating and useful technology for those sorts of crimes. As I said in my introduction, I think it certainly has many good applications, but it could also be abused. So we have to be very careful.
Well, there are privacy, and there are privacy issues as a result. And people say to me, how do you feel about the privacy? And I said, well, there are conflicting now. There's someone's right to privacy from their DNA. Like, I can track you from an extended relative you've never met. And when I look at my 23andMe DNA profile, and your DNA and my DNA are going to be broadly similar, I have 1,092 extended relatives on 23andMe and Ancestry.com, most of whom I've never even met. One of them is Donald J. Trump. And Donald Trump's mother, Mary Ann McLeod, comes from the village next door to my great-grandfather, John McLeod, and our common ancestor is Angus the Bard in 1462. So sometimes you can find out some really shocking stuff from your own DNA. But the point is, the privacy isn't there anymore. And this would scare privacy advocates, and I think would scare you too a bit. But if I've got to balance my right to privacy to my DNA versus a child's right to know who their father is and get education support from that father, I think the child's right dominates over my right to privacy.
Fascinating. And I'm sure that this will be a subject for lawyers to discuss in years to come or much sooner.
You know why we're doing it? We're doing it because I left working for the UN because I got sick to death of the child abuse and women abuse at the hands of aid workers. There is no greater imbalance of power than that between aid worker and aid beneficiary in a conflict zone or a new natural disaster. And predators now target the aid industry to get access to children. And the easiest way to get access to children is to join a children's charity. So sex abusing pedophiles deliberately target the UN and NGO to get access to children. And if you doubt that, get people just to Google food for sex scandal and see what came up in West Africa in the 2000s, the whistleblower scandal in Bosnia in the mid-1990s, the Oxfam scandal that we heard of more recently. And there is now a mountain of evidence that for 30 years, the UN and NGOs have been deliberately turning a blind eye to sex abuse and pedophilia within their own staff. And in 2009, I said, enough. And I quit the UN and I've been on this advocacy trail for 13 years now. And I created this DNA technology back in 2017. So that's 5 years now. And we're just going to hold these bastards to account, one after the other, after the other, after the other.
Great to hear, Andrew. Now, we do need to go to the news headlines. This is TNT Radio.
Matt Boyland here with a look at your TNT headlines. After striking a security deal with China back in April, the Solomon Islands has told Pacific nations invited to a White House meeting with President Biden that it will not be signing their summit declaration. Ukraine's vowed to jail its citizens who voted in a Russian-backed referendum in the country's east and south, and gas continues to pour into the Baltic Sea from three giant holes in Russia's Nord Stream 1 and 2 pipelines after they were damaged in an apparent act of sabotage.
Free speech is in our DNA.
Experimental vaccines will never change that.
Listen to TNT Radio anywhere you go. Yeah, even there. Never miss out on the news and views of the big issues of the day. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio.
Or download the TNT Radio app for free.
From the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
This is Jeremy Beck, and my guest is Professor Andrew McLeod. Now, Andrew, let's shift focus. I'd like to discuss Ukraine, Russia-America relations, because I think this is incredibly important. The last thing we need is nuclear war. I think it is a danger, but I think also both sides don't want it, but an accident is still a risk. What's your assessment?
Oh, we are in a much more dangerous position now than we were in the Cuban Missile Crisis. Let's be really clear about that. And an escalation to so-called tactical nuclear weapons is very, very possible, maybe even probable now. And once you let that cat out of the bag and you normalize the use of nuclear weapons, it's going to be very difficult to stop an escalation. We had an opportunity in 2014. Of maybe resolving Russia-Ukraine issue by recognizing that Crimea actually technically was part of Russia. You know, Crimea was governed by Russia in the Soviet days until 1953-54 when Khrushchev gave it to Ukraine. And what you had left over when the Soviet Union collapsed was a largely Russian-speaking area, Crimea, that was given to the sovereign state of Ukraine, whereas most people have recognized that most of the people in Crimea actually wanted to be part of Russia. The problem is Russia then implemented a process that's totally invalid. You can't invade an area and take it. There was an opportunity in 2014 to start renegotiating and say, Russia, if you recognize Kosovo as independent, we'll recognize Crimea as part of Russia. That could have been done, but it wasn't. And now we are where we are, where you can't reward Vladimir Putin for his aggression. So Crimea has to stay part of Ukraine. And certainly the other parts that Russia has now invaded have to stay part of Ukraine. The problem is Putin can't agree to that. So one of three things is going to happen. Either Putin is going to fall in an internal coup, and I don't see that as likely. And if that did happen, the person who's likely to replace him will probably be worse. Secondly, Ukraine and Russia will grind out a stalemate that will last for decades. Transnistria has been going on 30 years. Western Sahara has been going since 1976. These sorts of stalemates can drag on for decades. Or the third thing is Russia suffers a humiliating defeat in which they are more likely to use nuclear weapons. None of those scenarios is good, but they're the three we're facing.
And what sort of time frame do you see this is playing out? I can see this potentially dragging on for years. Look at what happened in Afghanistan and Iraq. How do you see it?
Well, I think a stalemate can drag on for decades. I mean, South Ossetia has been dragging on since 1991, Transnistria since 1991, Western Sahara since 1976. East Timor went from 1976 to 2002 before a resolution was found. So absolutely, this can go for decades. You know, the people who are counting the number of days, you know, this invasion has gone 300 days, it's gone 320 days. I mean, come on, this can go for decades. And probably the best outcome for people in Australia is a dragged out stalemate, because the quicker resolutions are much more nasty globally than a dragged out stalemate. But for the people of Ukraine, a dragged out stalemate is horrible.
I think that there is another solution which no one is looking at, and that is what a regular guest at TNT Radio, Matthew Errett, and he's the co-founder of the Rising Tide Foundation. And this is in relation to China and the United States, but also any nation, Russia. It's people in leadership layers in the United States and in Russia. They've got to get together, have a meeting, and say, hang on, let's just put all our differences aside and have a multipolar world where we can all rise together and all have win-win relationships, because this is all political. There's no real reason other than big egos and vested interests, big powers.
So if you have a look at rise and falls of great empires over the centuries, the British, the Dutch, over centuries, what you find is a declining power always starts a war with a rising power, because the declining power finds it culturally hard to accept that they're no longer number one. So for us to move to a peaceful transition to a multipolar world and potentially a Chinese-dominated world, if their economy and military does get as big as everyone's predicting, you've then got to ask yourself, is the United States culturally capable of accepting that they're number two? And I don't think the United States is culturally capable of doing that. So even though I would prefer to live in a US-dominated world than a Chinese-dominated world, I think an upcoming conflict is more likely to be started by the United States than started by China. And I think the flashpoint is Taiwan, because so many people misunderstand Taiwan. Taiwan is legally, technically, Chinese territory. Who says so? China says so, US says so, UK says so, Australia says so, and Taiwan says so. And this is what people don't understand. See, Taiwan, in Article 5 of its own constitution, claims to be the government of all of China. So what you actually have isn't a so-called independent Taiwan, a democratic state trying to carve out its own independent identity with the big evil brother China overlooking them. No, 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 no. This is the continuity of the Civil War started in 1945. And remember, in 1945, the communists and the nationalists fought a civil war. The communists won, and the nationalists so-called retreated to Taiwan, as if Taiwan was empty. They didn't retreat to Taiwan. They invaded Taiwan. They dispossessed millions of indigenous people. They had 50 years of what was called the White Terror, where the indigenous people were repressed. We'd like to say now Taiwan is democratic. Well, this is brand new. They had their first democratic transition of power this century. But all through the 1900s, it was an evil military dictatorship that repressed and brutally repressed its indigenous people, right? Mm. They had an operation in their government called Operation Restore National Glory, which was a plan to reinvade the mainland. So when we now talk about let's support the people of Taiwan, are we supporting them in independence that they themselves haven't declared? Are we supporting them in the reinvasion of Taiwan and their declaration to govern all of China? And UN Resolution 2758 back in 1971 recognized there is one sovereign territory of China, but changed the recognized government from the nationalists in Taipei to the communists in Beijing. So when people say we recognized China in 1972, we didn't. We changed the recognition from Taipei to Beijing. But even Taipei was still claiming to govern all of China. In 1971, when the UN resolution passed, the Taiwanese had an opportunity to become an independent country, but they chose not to take it because they still claimed to govern all of China. And it's bewildering to me that people come out and say, let's support the independence of Taiwan, when not even Taiwan is asking for independence.
So what people are saying is we should support Taiwan. What they're effectively saying is we should support the invasion of all of China because Taiwan says that we control all of China, which is nuts. I mean, we'd have World War III, wouldn't we?
Yeah. Now, people respond and say, but the current president of Taiwan has said that she will never claim that provision in Article 5 of the Constitution, to which my response is, well, if you believe a presidential statement overrules a constitution, then welcome to the world of Donald Trump saying the last election was stolen. Secondly, this is the current president. Well, what happens if the KMT win the next election and the KMT, the current opposition party in Taiwan, still claims that they want to govern all of China? What happens if there's a change in next election? You're exactly right. From the Chinese perspective, if you're saying you are supporting the Taiwanese government and the Taiwanese constitution currently says in Article 5, they're the government of all of China, you are saying to the government in Beijing, we are supporting an invasion and an overthrow of you. Now, tell me, how does that not lead to a horrible war?
Exactly. And I think very few Australians would have a clue about that. Probably very few Americans would have a clue about that. People just don't understand the history, do they, Andrew?
Correct. And I was accused on Twitter recently of being a mouthpiece of the Chinese government because I said Taiwan is not independent. And I pointed back to these people. Here is the link to the State Department's website in the United States. And the State Department website says in the clearest possible terms, we do not support the independence of Taiwan. So you're saying I'm the mouthpiece of China because I'm repeating the statement on the US State Department's website? Mm. You know, you can't be more clearer. We do not support the independence of Taiwan. That's what the current State Department says. That's what Australian foreign policy says. It's what the UK foreign policy says. And it's what the EU foreign policy says. So if we don't support the independence of Taiwan, and Taiwan hasn't claimed independence, and Article 5 of Taiwan's constitution says they're the government of all of China, what the hell are we doing? You know, we are gleefully waving flags, skipping along, saying, let's now have a war with China. And the result of that's going to be what exactly? And let's be clear about this. I would love Taiwan to be an independent democratic country. You know, I support democracy over autocracy every single time. But what I don't support is a brutal war, which will be world destroying.
I think so. I very much so. And you've seen some so-called gaffes from President Biden over Taiwan, really contradicting the US official policy. What do you make of that? Just quickly before we go to a break.
I don't think they're gaps. I think the United States is setting up to go to war because they are the declining power. China is the rising power. And all through history, the declining power has started the war.
Yes, well, I think that's a very worrying state of affairs if that's the case. I mean, gaffes, yeah, I'm inclined to agree in terms of the deep state, the apparatus in the United States probably told him to say that, but at the same time, maybe he's just going off script. I don't know. But if that is the intention, that is a big, big worry.
Remember, now, President Eisenhower, yeah, a Republican president, a military general, was the one who warned against the military deep state.
A right-wing
general warned about it.
That's right. I've seen his speech. We will go to a break now and we'll be right back soon. This is TNT Radio.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
So who knew that the state of California is 45% smarter than the state of New York? Or are they? Well, according to published reports, last winter, both states purchased the same COVID-19 home test, but New York paid about 45% more per test than California. The Times Union reports New York Governor Kathy Hochul's administration bought 52 million of the CareStar test manufactured by the New Jersey-based firm Access Bio. Now, unlike California, New York purchased tests through an intermediary, New Jersey-based distributor Digital Gadgets, a company owned by a New York family that has, get this, donated nearly $300,000 to Hochul's campaign. California bought the test directly from Access Bio. So why would Hochul's administration use the intermediary owned by a family that donated big time to her campaign? Let's have an investigation to find out and hope that in the meantime, she doesn't win re-election in November. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg on TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Big tech companies are notorious for censoring inconvenient views. Any search for a contested topic online, Google and other search engines almost invariably rank the most politically correct views higher. Social media giants will deplatform anyone upsetting the globalists' agenda, even if they are the US president. Big tech employs so-called fact-checkers who attempt to discredit highly qualified experts not towing the establishment line. But when government officials make indisputable errors, the fact-checkers are nowhere in sight. The London-based fact-checking organisation Full Fact has worked with big tech giants including Facebook, Google and Twitter. Full Fact's head of communications, Ross Haig, was formerly head of communications of the Behavioural Insights team, the notorious Nudge Unit, which employ psychological techniques to manipulate public behaviours and attitudes.
The news everyone is talking about. TNT Radio, where the longer you listen, the more reasons you find to keep listening. Lighting the fuse for freedom. TNT Radio.
This is Jeremy Beck, and my guest is Professor Andrew McLeod. So we've got about 13 minutes left, and I'd like to discuss anything that you would like. I did have a few things in mind, but is there anything pressing that you want to talk about in the last few minutes?
The only thing is my frustration with COVID at the moment. I just tested positive yesterday and I now have to isolate in a hotel room for the next 5 days. But c'est la vie. No, I think what we need to touch on is the need for the Australian population to become a lot more well-informed over some of these really critical events that are taking place. And the Republic, we need to understand who we are as a country and have enough pride to say we don't need an elitist, born to rule, foreign family to be our head of state. That's one. On Ukraine, we need to understand this can drag on for a long time. But to be frank, I think Vladimir Putin is now starting to understand how much of a puppet of the Chinese he is, because Ukraine is the testing ground for the Chinese to understand what they can and can't get away with Taiwan. And thirdly, the Americans are really driving us to a conflict with China, and most people misunderstand the realities of Taiwan, that it is not legally independent, it has never been legally independent, and Taiwan's constitution still claims to govern all of China. So when we say we're going to back the Taiwanese, exactly what are we backing them to do? Invade the mainland?
Well, it's a real worry. Now, I see that this agenda has been ongoing. You would well know about the Project for the New American Century, which I believe no longer exists. But this is a neocon agenda. It can't end very well if the United States uses its military might to keep pushing further and further to bigger nations. It's bad enough in Afghanistan or Iraq. But so where do you see it headed?
Well, this is a really good point, because the Americans love to say, you know, we've got this great, powerful military, to which I point out, okay, with your great, powerful military, since the end of World War II, can you please list for me the wars you've actually won? Because my reading of it is, you lost Vietnam, you lost Afghanistan, you really have lost Iraq, you did win Grenada, I'll give you that one. You won the war in Grenada, well done you. So even with this big, powerful military, that doesn't mean you're actually going to win. And if you go to war with China, what makes you think you're going to win? And let's now look at this from a military perspective. China now has the world's largest navy by ship numbers, not by tonnage. They've got small ships designed for the Taiwan Strait. If you fought a war in Taiwan, China's supply lines are going to be a couple of hundred kilometers long. US supply lines are going to be thousands of kilometers long. How's that working out for the Russians in Ukraine at the moment to have the longest supply lines? And this is what we've got to understand. Yes, you can be proud about yourself, and yes, you can be proud about your culture, and let's be happy that we live in democracies, not autocracies, but let's not be arrogant about this to the extent that you then misunderstand your own power. A war with China will be democracies, but let's not be arrogant about this to the extent that you then misunderstand your own power. A war with China will be devastating.
Absolutely. Now, I hope that's not the first symptoms of COVID. Now, you mentioned you tested positive. From what I understand, so many people have caught it and have had very mild symptoms. It seems totally ridiculous to me that you're forced to isolate. It should be just a matter of course. If anything, it would be a good thing for it to spread around, for people to get immunity, natural immunity, and it would be all over.
I think that depends where you are. Like, I literally arrived in Abu Dhabi last night in UAE, and I tested on arrival because I was due to fly to Djibouti tomorrow. I need to give a negative PCR test to enter Djibouti. So that's how I tested and found out I was positive. Until these sneezings, and I think it's more to do with the grapes I was just eating, I didn't have any symptoms and don't have any symptoms right now. And I've spent the last week in Syria, of all places. And if anyone wants to see what Syria looks like today, go to my YouTube channel, Andrew McLeod. I just uploaded the video that I did there last week. So I think it depends where you are. In fully vaccinated societies, I think, or where vaccines are fully available and people can choose whether they take the vaccine or not, I think, look, let it run now, let people out. I think it was a very different dynamic when we didn't know 2 years ago, and I was a big fan, as bad as it sounds, of the lockdowns until the vaccines came out. And I spent 274 days in my own home in Melbourne, and I accepted that inconvenience. But now that the vaccines are available and people can choose to take them or not take them, let the damn thing run. That's definitely my view now. And I got lucky, because Abu Dhabi on Monday changed the isolation period from 10 days to 5. So I only have to do 5 days, whereas last week I would have had to have done 10.
Right. Well, I know that many people in my circle of friends and relatives who have not taken the jabs and they've caught COVID and they said it's just like a mild cold. I understand some people got very sick and died, elderly people, people with comorbidities. It's a serious disease for them. But I think it was an absolute crime to force people to either take a jab or lose their job. I think it's an absolute disgrace what they did there in Australia and the lockdowns, of course. But before, because we've only got a few minutes left or about 6 or 7 minutes, I want to hear more about Syria, because fascinating country, and they have had a major potential for a major conflict, which Russia intervened in. And it seemed like an attempted regime change operation that didn't end up happening. Just tell us more.
I think that's probably correct. You know, in many ways, the West took the wrong lesson from Iraq. The lesson in Iraq wasn't don't intervene. The lesson in Iraq is if you do intervene, you've got to rebuild a country properly. And I like to say to people, when did the last Allied soldier leave Germany after World War II? Answer, they haven't. When did the last Allied soldier leave Japan after World War II? Answer, they haven't. For Germany and Japan after World War II, we gave a multi-generational commitment to rebuild and reconstruct those countries until they became part of the international community. But somehow in Afghanistan and Iraq, we thought we could go in, bomb, and then leave within 10 years and everything would be fine. That was never going to work. So we then got scared of having appropriate interventions. And there was an opportunity in 2014, 2015 for a small-scale intervention in Syria that could have removed President Assad if you had then a commitment to rebuild the country. But because that wasn't done, and because there are so many complicated forces at play in Syria, Kurds versus the Turks, Kurdish independence in Turkey, Syria, Iran, all going against each other, Assad getting backing from the Russians, the US wanting to get rid of Assad and wanting to back the Kurds, but the Kurds are the enemy of the Turks and the Turks are in part of NATO. And then you had ISIS terrorists on top of that. And then you had the Free Syrian Army fighting the Syrians. It is the most complicated context I've ever been to. I was in Yugoslavia during the wars, understood it, was in Rwanda during the genocide, I understood that. Syria, I don't understand in total. It's just too complicated with too many players interfacing with each other. And I think that's just one of the ones where we're going to have to put our hands up and say, wow, they've got to resolve it themselves. The problem is most Syrian people are lovely people, like most human beings around the world are. They sit down, had nice coffees, had great guides. There's amazing history in that country. Christian history, the Saul's conversion to Christianity on the road to Damascus is literally outside Damascus, and you can walk on the same road. It could be a great country if its politics was right, but so could Lebanon, but its politics is bad. And sometimes in countries like Australia, we don't understand how lucky we are. And when we go to other places like Syria and Lebanon and see how those countries are falling to bits and how the average person is really suffering for the politics of it, you just feel sorry for them. I mean, and anyone who's interested, seriously, go to YouTube, look up Andrew McLeod, and I literally put up the video about 4 or 5 hours ago, and you can see through my eyes a subjective opinion on what it looks like.
Wow. And are you able to say whether you talked to any politicians there or any leadership layers? If you can't say anything, that's fine.
I spoke to the tourism minister because I just happened to bump into him in Aleppo, and we just have a bit of a chat, but I didn't speak in any detail. Syria is a country I've wanted to go to for years because of its phenomenal history. Aleppo, as well as being a city known for the conflict now, is actually the oldest city in the world, and Damascus is the oldest capital city in the world. So you've got literally thousands of years of history in these places and so much to learn by going there. So my purpose was just to learn and understand the history of the place, not to go in and negotiate with the government.
Yeah, because I know that Syria has had a long history with Christians and Muslims living side by side in peace. Mm. Did you see evidence of that?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, I had two guides in Aleppo. One was Christian and one was Muslim. And, you know, I said to them, there's a golden rule. Every time I'm offered coffee, I say yes. So we sat down and had lots of cups of coffee in lots of places. So, yeah, I did see a lot of that. And take the Umayyad Mosque in Damascus, for example. The Umayyad Mosque was initially an Armenian temple to Hadad, the god, prior to Christianity. It then became a Roman temple to Jupiter. It then became a Christian cathedral to John the Baptist, and the head of John the Baptist is still in there, and now it's a mosque, and it's the fourth holiest place in Islam because the Muslims believe this is where Jesus will come before the end of days. And a lot of Christians forget that Jesus is venerated in Islam. He's not the Messiah, but he is the prophet. Not only is he a prophet, he's the second most important prophet in all of Islam.
Mm. And did you see much rebuilding going on in Syria after this war? Yeah. Mm. And Aleppo, what do you see the future is for?
It depends on the politics. You know, when you drive out of Aleppo through Idlib back to Damascus, you see the front lines. And I described it on my video as it doesn't look like old front lines. It looks like front lines waiting to be reused. So you see this rebuilding going on and you've got a bit of hope. But then you see the tensions are still there and peace is not secured in all of the country. ISIS is still there. The Kurds are still there. The Russians are still there. You know, so there is no definitive resolution in Syria yet. So there is reason for optimism, but there's a lot of reason for pessimism too.
Well, let's hope they can rebuild and there's no interference again. I mean, there are a lot of major world powers in the region who are always intervening in the affairs of smaller nations, which is problematic for those smaller nations. But it's been fantastic to have you TNT Radio, Andrew. Can you just quickly say how people can find out more about you in the few seconds we have left?
Just Google Andrew McLeod, M-A-C-L-E-O-D. If you don't put the A in, you get a Canadian photographer or the Australian rules footballer. So just Andrew McLeod, King's College London, and things will come up. Or Andrew McLeod, Griffin Law, things will come up and find your way to my YouTube channel.
Okay, fantastic. Great to have you on TNT Radio, Professor Andrew McLeod. I highly recommend you check out his material online. We're coming up to the news break in a few seconds. This is TNT Radio.